It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out what state Republicans' priorities are for 2019 with a new Democratic governor and attorney general.
First, we're going to hear what state Democratic lawmakers are planning. While voters in the November midterms elected Tony Evers to run the state and Josh Call as the state's attorney general, Republicans continue to hold majorities in the legislature.
They lost just one assembly seat to give them a 63-36 advantage, and they picked up a Senate seat for a 19-14 edge. So what does divided government mean for legislative Democrats in the state?
Jennifer Schilling is a Democratic state senator from La Crosse and the Senate Minority Leader. Senator Schilling, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be on. And Rob, you've kept me company many afternoons as I travel west and leave the Capitol to come home to La Crosse.
It's a long commute.
To be on the show. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for joining us. Now, it's been a while since we've had divided government here in Wisconsin. What are your feelings about that now, the new look for Wisconsin government going into 2019?
Characterized it as an arranged marriage, that the voters demonstrated that they wanted to move into a new direction, and after years of single-party control, they elected Democratic governor, Democratic attorney general, re-elected Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, as well as a treasurer and secretary of state's office. And I think that demonstrates that there is fatigue as far as the voters in a divisive kind of leadership style of divide and conquer. And Governor-elect Evers has talked about wanting to bring people together, look for common ground issues, to be a problem solver. And he's not one that wants to pick a fight daily or weekly with the legislature. And so it will be a new landscape, certainly, and a new dynamic for Republicans who have never served under a Democratic governor and in that area. But I think, you know, we need each other in the legislature in order to be successful. And in this arranged marriage, Republicans need Democrats in order for the bills to get through the legislature and onto the governor's desk, and that we support those that the governor would sign. But Republicans need us in order to support those bills and have a Democrat sign them. We need to have our bills heard. We need to get them through both houses. So it's a unique relationship, and certainly I hope it brings some moderation.
Before we get into specific issues for 2019, let's take a look at this extraordinary session that we just had in the legislature. Republicans passed a number of measures, some of which limit the powers of the governor, the incoming governor, and attorney general. What do you think about how all of that went down?
Well, it was a bait and switch. We were originally supposed to be in a special session for a Kimberly Clark vote, and there were not the votes there for that package. And they kept the door open on the extraordinary session and put forward bills that strip the power of the new incoming Democratic governor and attorney general, consolidate power into the Joint Finance Committee and legislative committees that are controlled by the Republicans. We would have never been in special session on those bills had Scott Walker and Brad Schimmel been reelected. So I think it is pretty desperate on Republicans' behalf that they move forward with that legislation, that in the court of public opinion, it's a loser on, that they put forward those bills that change the rules with a Democratic administration.
One of the arguments from Republicans is that, hey, we've done good stuff. Unemployment is low. The economy is looking pretty good in Wisconsin. We want to just change a couple things so that the governor, the incoming governor, can't unilaterally change the good stuff we've done. What do you say to that?
Well, again, the voters voted for Tony Evers, who talked about Medicaid expansion in this state. The voters supported Josh Call, who talked about withdrawing Wisconsin from the federal ACA lawsuit. That those are things that I have heard over and over at these listening sessions that Governor-elect Evers has been conducting around the state. And the Republicans handcuffed the incoming governor to be able to do that. And now, basically, the governor needs to seek permission from the legislative leaders and the finance committee to enter or withdraw from lawsuits for the attorney general, or to look at different waivers and pilot programs, for an example, in the Medicaid program. So it is one that is hamstringing the incoming administration.
Talking to State Senator Jennifer Schilling from La Crosse. She's the Senate Minority Leader. We're looking at the year ahead now in Wisconsin politics. And looking ahead, Senator Schilling, one issue that's remained kind of unresolved for years now is transportation funding, how we pay for road construction and maintenance in Wisconsin. Do you see this as an opportunity for you and Republicans to work together and get something signed by Governor-elect Evers?
You know, I do. And for several sessions at the end of the year, that's been one of my regrets. I've pointed to that issue that we have not come forward with a long-term sustainable funding mechanism. And really, I think in the past there was support across the aisle and within parties to do something. But Governor Scott Walker was always the hurdle with his veto pen. And so I hope we do start off with an issue that Democrats and Republicans can work together on and build trust. The public wants us to be problem solvers, and certainly the transportation issue is not one that is getting any easier. And in fact, during the lame duck legislation, actually, it makes it more difficult to address some of the funding transportation issues that we do have in the state because of changes that Republicans put forward. But we need some issue to build trust and go forward on, and maybe transportation is that issue. We'll see who Governor-elect Evers appoints as the transportation secretary, and certainly that tone will come from that department to try to bring legislators together and find a solution.
In just a few minutes, we'll be talking to Republican Assembly Representative John Nygren. He's done a lot on the opioid issue here in the state. A lot of legislation has been passed with bipartisan support. Do you see next steps in 2019 on those issues?
I'm sure we'll continue to, there will be issues that will, such as the opioid legislation. I think I'm hearing more about methamphetamines. And so as we look at addiction in this state, how are we helping to address that and rehabilitate folks and help them? So I hope that there are those areas. And I know that I've recently met with Counties Association, our Health and Human Services Director here in La Crosse County, and there are a lot of issues affecting children and our human services, and I hope that we can look for some resolution there, but also within our juvenile correctional system. And last session, in a bipartisan effort, looking at how we need to reform juvenile justice and changes to Lincoln Hills in northern Wisconsin in a regional approach, and I hope that we can build off of that bipartisanship and find some long-term solutions to be good partners, better partners with our counties when it comes to juvenile corrections.
Apart from the issues we've talked about so far, what's at the top of your agenda for the legislature in 2019?
Well, I think it's many of the issues that Governor-elect Evers, he talked about. We echo those about supporting public education, long-term transportation fixes, addressing health care, and making sure that folks have with pre-existing conditions have those protections in the state. But it's also issues like expanding child care assistance and help to, tax incentives for working families, a child care credit, a student loan debt. I hear from many young people as they graduate and the loan debt that they carry. But also looking at, tax fairness across the board for people, and retirement security for working families, and broadband connectivity. And again, that should be a bipartisan effort. We talk about economic development and making sure that our rural communities are connected, and broadband is that connector to help small businesses and economic development.
Since you're from the western part of the state, I've heard from lawmakers and others over many years, decades now, that people in western Wisconsin feel sometimes forgotten by the capital, the media in south central and southeastern Wisconsin. Do you see that? And if so, what do you see as solutions for that?
We certainly want to make sure that we have the same challenges that other parts of the state, other regions have with wanting to support our schools and make sure our public schools are funded adequately. It's workforce development and talent retention. But in western Wisconsin, recently it's flood recovery, and we need to make sure that our small towns and our homeowners and small businesses receive help and partnership with the state on flood recovery and looking at flood mitigation. And we have roads and bridges that were washed away. Our local units of government, our towns, are not prepared to with revenue limits to be able to fix that. And we have a bridge in Vernon County that was out in the flood 2 years ago, and it's still not open to the public. And so we need to make sure that all of Wisconsin is strong and has opportunities for success. Our urban areas, our suburban areas, and our rural areas as well.
And as we wrap up, a lot of people might look at this setup, divided government, and think, great, 2 years of gridlock. Do you think that we will see stuff get done?
The tone comes from the governor's office and from his administration. The tone comes from Republican and Democratic leaders and giving kind of permission and a culture of wanting to work together. Today I read that Republicans in the legislature are going to, they want to ignore Governor-elect Evers' budget and just work off of their own Republican budget. That pettiness is tiring to the public, and we need to figure out a way that we navigate this new landscape together, but understanding that Governor Evers has extended an olive branch, he has met with leaders, and, you know, their Republican criticism is pretty predictable, and I think it will be tiring to the public and to the voters over the next couple years.
Senator Schilling, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jennifer Schilling is a Democratic state senator from La Crosse and the Senate Minority Leader. We talked to her about the legislature's lame duck session and Democratic priorities for 2019.
Coming up, we'll get the Republican side from Joint Finance Committee co-chair John Nygren. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, what does a giant dinosaur, a self-fertilizing corn, and a new Mars robot all have in common? These are some of the biggest science stories of the year. We'll talk about the year in science coming up.
Right now, Governor-elect Tony Evers will take office in about 2.5 weeks. He's pledged to cut income taxes for the middle class by 10%, increase funding for schools, fix and fund roads, and accept federal money to expand Medicaid.
But he'll have to work with Republicans who hold a 27-seat advantage in the Assembly and a 5-seat edge in the Senate. They also passed bills in the lame duck session earlier this month that limit some powers of the governor and attorney general.
John Nygren is a Republican state representative from Marinette and co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Representative Nygren, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Well, it's the first time we've seen a divided government in Wisconsin for a while. What are you looking ahead at, Republican legislature, Democratic governor?
Well, I mean, I think there's going to be some opportunities for us to work together. I mean, I think things such as the opioid abuse, something that I've worked on. I think that's going to be a very bipartisan issue as we move into divided government. I think continuing to prioritize, education. We may have different views on how we get there and how much investment we make, but I think we both have those things in common. And from our perspective, I think we want to make sure that we continue to grow our economy and at the same time also focus on workforce development, because we got thousands of jobs that are out there that are going unfilled because we don't have the either we don't have the number of people to fill those positions or we don't have the number of people with those skills to fill those positions. So I think those are going to be some of the things that we can find some common ground on.
We'll dig into some specifics on those in a bit. I want to start with the extraordinary session. Over the last couple of weeks, among other things, your party did pass bills to curb some of the authority of the governor and the attorney general. Can you make the case now that those are passed?
Well, I heard the way you defined it as, I guess, curbed or some. I think the way it was portrayed in the media, I heard terms such as, power grab and weaken the governor. You know, when I called back constituents over the last couple of weeks and I asked them specifically what type of powers does Tony Evers not have today that he had 2 weeks ago, most constituents couldn't point to anything specific. I believe that it was, from our perspective, it was a balance of power issue and making sure that a governor coming in, newly elected, yes, has a lot of power, but he shouldn't be able to undo what has been supported by both House of Legislature, signed into law by the governor, just because he was against it. He should have to work with us at the table to negotiate to change things that had been previously passed.
Would you have made these changes if Governor Walker had won re-election?
I mean, I think that's a fair question. Actually, if you look at the number of proposals and things that were actually changed, I think about 75% of them had either been already proposed passed into law, passed through the legislature. Some of them had been vetoed by Governor Walker, and I do believe it may not have been in a lame duck session, but I do believe that there would have been negotiations to make these changes, because we believe strongly that we have the three different branches of government. The only way to truly be successful and to represent all corners of Wisconsin is to have them all equally at the table. So yes, I do believe we would have been having these conversations with Governor Walker if he had been successful.
Now, Governor Walker announced this Kimberly Clark deal last week before he signed these new changes into law. What do you think of this deal? The Senate wasn't able to pass something on Kimberly Clark and trying to keep those jobs. What do you make of this deal that the governor has announced?
Well, I mean, these are we had testimony in Joint Finance going back a few weeks ago in Kimberly Clark. I mean, these are good paying jobs, and to be upfront with you folks, I actually represent a community, Marinette, that has a Kimberly Clark plant in it. It's not necessarily affected by the potential closure of the Cold Spring plant, but these are good paying jobs. They're union jobs. They're family supporting jobs. They have been around for generations in Wisconsin, and I think I appreciate the governor's leadership to actually get us to a point where we can. We can work together with Kimberly Clark to make sure that those jobs are not only in Marinette, but in, Nina and throughout the whole state for generations to come.
Talking to State Representative John Nygren, Republican from Marinette, co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, looking ahead to 2019 in Wisconsin government. You mentioned roads and transportation. This has been a sticking point in budgets in Wisconsin for quite a while now. Do you see specific ways of either increasing funding for roads or doing more triage to spend what money we have?
Well, I mean, I do think there's been some creative ways already that have been implemented by the Department of Transportation as far as using the resources the people of the state already have given them. But I do believe long-term we need to reevaluate how we fund roads, because gas tax is not keeping up with the pace of inflation for road projects. Cars are becoming more and more fuel efficient, so that revenue stream is not reliable in the future. So I do believe that both parties need to sit down and address how we're going to fund roads, not just today, but into the future. That doesn't necessarily mean a gas tax increase. That doesn't just necessarily mean a registration fee increase. But it's a true conversation about what the future of transportation looks like and how we fund it.
And you mentioned your work on opioid-related issues. I talked to Senator Schilling about this. You've passed a couple packages of legislation. Where do you still see room for improvement, for new interventions?
Well, I think one of the biggest opportunities for us in this coming session is to continue some of the work we've actually already started. Pew Charitable Trust, a nonpartisan group that works nationally with legislatures throughout the country, they actually chose us and one other legislature to work with to help us even strengthen our policies even more. We are looking to develop even a stronger system of treatment in Wisconsin, and one of the ways that we're going to do that is through the development of what's called a hub-and-spoke model. We spent the last 9 months or so studying how that would be implemented in Wisconsin. So rather than simply moving ahead, we wanted to make sure that we understood the different challenges we face as we go towards implementation. So going into the next legislative session, I believe that's going to be the biggest challenge for us is to now implement those ideas so that we can expand. I believe that if we do this, we could more than double the treatment availability in Wisconsin just by changing how we deliver that treatment.
Now, one of the biggest things Governor-elect Evers will do is issue his budget proposal sometime, in theory, early next year. Some of the Republican leaders in both chambers have already talked about crafting their own budget. Do you want to wait and see what the Governor-elect has to say before you dive in and make your own plan?
Well, I mean, I think we're always, this is split government. I think that this is the way it's intended to work. So Tony Evers will, introduce his budget probably later in February, maybe into March. And I'm sure he'll travel the state promoting why he believes in what he's proposing. But the legislature, being Republican majorities, will craft a budget and take it to the people in the very same way. And at the end of the day, I think there's going to have to be a give and take between the governor and the legislature. There's going to be things that he likes that gets done, and there's going to be things that we like that gets done, and there's going to be things that neither one of us are happy with. So that's the decision that the people of Wisconsin made with a split government. And I don't believe that I believe that's a completely appropriate conversation that needs to be taken to the people, and they can actually help us decide which course is better.
I asked Senator Schilling about some of the unique issues facing her part of the state in western Wisconsin. Are there things going on in northeastern Wisconsin that you think maybe people in the rest of the state don't know about or overlook?
Well, I mean, the economic development aspect I talked about, I mean, Marinette Marine is a very strong, you know, economic driver in not only Marinette, but I mean, I think it's throughout the state. It's attributed to about 5,500 jobs in the state of Wisconsin, and their future growth is something that's vital for us. But also being able to fill those positions, I mean, and really good paying jobs in the community where it's very low cost to live and to raise a family. But I would also say there's some other issues, things like, you know, we've got some groundwater issues that are affecting my hometown based on some what are called PFOAs. This is based on a local manufacturer that has had some contamination over the years that's now affecting some of the wells. I think those are some of the issues that we all need to come together. And I think Republicans and Democrats, it doesn't matter. I mean, we all want clean water. So it's a matter of what systems can we put in place to make sure that we can assist when problems like that develop.
Our last minute and a half or so, as I asked Senator Schilling again, people might look at divided government and think, uh-oh, gridlock on the way, nothing's going to get done. How do you respond to that concern?
Well, I mean, I guess I've had some people say to me, you know, I'm not sending you to pass any one specific bill. I'm sending you to work on in my best interest. And I don't know that necessarily that means that we have to accomplish, you know, a preconceived list of ideas, but it comes down to, you know, listening to the folks that sent us here, and being flexible enough to work with the other side, especially in divided government. But at the end of the day, you know, like you mentioned the budget, for example, and at the end of the day, Wisconsin's not like the federal government. If we don't pass a budget, we don't shut down. Right, we actually will continue the services that people have grown to expect will continue. So, I mean, I don't know that gridlock is necessarily in Wisconsin what they might see at the federal level.
We'll leave it there and watch what's going on at the federal level too. Representative Nygren, thanks a lot for joining us.
You guys I hope you have a great holiday season.
And you, thanks a lot. That's John Nygren, Republican State Representative from Marinette, co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. We talked with him about the lame duck session and the Republican priorities for the year ahead. Earlier, we talked to Senate Minority Leader Democrat Jennifer Schilling.
Coming up, we'll look back at some of the biggest news in science this year. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Perry.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, have you ever been obsessed with a TV series or a book? Maybe you've even discussed and analyzed favorite parts online with other fans. We talk about the sense of community and the science of being a fan with a psychology expert.
First, 2018 saw a lot of big news in the science world, from NASA engineers safely delivering a new lander to the surface of Mars to controversies around gene editing in human embryos and the discovery of the largest known land-roaming dinosaur in South Africa. It's been a big year for scientific discoveries, policies, and more.
Joining us to recap the biggest science news of the year is Bill Andrews. He's a senior associate editor of Discover Magazine. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
And also with us, Anna Groves, who is the assistant editor of Discover Magazine. Anna, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Anna, let's start with you. And let's start with a look at the Earth. Namely climate change. A big report came out this year that painted a pretty dire picture. Can you give us a quick overview of some of the warning in this report?
Sure. So this was the National Climate Assessment that was released on Black Friday this year. And the assessment is really thorough, and it just breaks down all sorts of the effects of climate change from every angle. So it goes through all different sectors, agriculture, transportation, human health. And it also breaks things down by region, so we can read just the Midwest section if we so desire. So one of the really startling projections to me was that they're expecting that due to the changes in rain and temperatures that are expected from climate change, Midwestern agricultural yields are expected to go down back to what they were in the 1980s.
Wow. We've talked a lot about the political reaction to the climate change report, but what was the reaction among scientists?
Among scientists, I think it was a lot of what we already knew. It was nice to see it all so thoroughly laid out in such an accessible way. But scientists have known a lot of these details for a long time. I think we weren't terribly surprised.
So what did the report say that governments and people can do to stem climate change?
I think a lot of the main message was that any action is better than no action, and that in addition to working on reducing our emissions, we should really be focused on preparing ourselves for some of these climate impacts in the future.
What is your confidence about this issue moving forward and developing in a positive direction?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I feel like based on how many years we've been talking about climate change and how it doesn't seem like, I mean, we're always taking baby steps to make it better in some ways, but I feel like we keep hearing about baby steps in the wrong direction too. So I'm trying to stay optimistic, but I'm not so sure.
Bill, let's look off planet now. There have been two big stories in space travel the last few years. Though given the size of space, they've technically been in the works for a long time. But let's look at a trip to one of our solar neighbors first. NASA scientists landed the first Mars InSight probe late last month. Tell us about what the goals are for this in particular.
Yeah, that's a very important probe for NASA. And it's easy to forget about why, you know, we need to examine Mars so much. It seems like every week they're sending something else to Mars, right? But the truth is that it isn't really every week, every other week. It's a few years apart. Curiosity rover was 2012 was when it landed, so it's been a while. And it's important because Mars is still the easiest planet we can get to that isn't Earth. So in science speak, an N of one is never great. Whenever you just have one example to study, like Earth, you always want more of that. So being able to get to Mars and study different aspects of it, in particular, InSight is going to look at what makes Mars tick. It's going to look at the interior of it, determine the heat, determine, it's going to look for Mars quakes, which are, of course, earthquakes on Mars. So it's going to really tell scientists a lot about what is going on beneath the surface of the red planet.
So how does the InSight probe work in tandem with other landers on Mars currently?
Well, they each kind of have their own domain, so to speak. They're not really going to be working together as a team. They're not going to interact per se, but they're each focusing on their own kind of part of the science. So Curiosity, the rover that landed in 2012, is looking at the possibility for life and habitability among the different environments of Mars and in the past, and isn't really able to look beneath the surface, can't drill in too far underground, doesn't detect Mars quakes. And so each different probe, each different satellite around Mars, too, has their own piece of the puzzle that they're looking at. And then it falls to us on Earth to be able to put all the different pieces together and kind of learn the story of Mars that way.
Bill Andrews is the senior associate director, associate editor of Discover Magazine. And Anna Groves.
That was good.
And Anna Groves is the assistant editor of Discover Magazine. And we're talking about some of the biggest science news of the year. The long-term goal, of course, Bill, is to get humans on Mars. So how would this probe help achieve that?
Well, again, any time that we can learn more about Mars gives us a better insight into what kind of shapes that planet. Already we've learned it's not, over the years we've learned it, it's had a very different past from Earth. It used to be much warmer. There used to be freshwater lakes on it, we're pretty sure at this point. And of course, right now, that isn't the case. It's desolate. It's dry and dusty and not very hospitable to life, as far as we know, maybe underground. But so every piece of information we can learn about what it's like on Mars, where this water might be hiding, if there is some, what the conditions are like everywhere, will help scientists know, you know, where to land, where we could send people, what they could scavenge for. Is it worth digging, trying to find water that way, or should they be prepared to bring all their own stuff? Just the whole picture, because it's something we've never done before. No humans have ever walked on another planet. So if we're going to make it there, if we're going to have a long-term base there, we still have a lot to figure out.
So looking a little further out, Voyager 2 was launched in more than 40 years ago. It was 1977. It finally reached interstellar space. How big of a deal is this?
It's a pretty big deal. I mean, it's not going to change our life walking down the street, right? But so little of science has a direct impact like that. And it's a really big deal for astronomers and I imagine Star Trek fans, because, of course, V'ger played a big role in one of the movies.
Yeah.
And it's only the second artificial satellite, the only second thing, as far as we know of, for sure, to have entered interstellar space. The first one being Voyager 1, which did it a few years ago. That's never happened before. They're still the only two things that have done that. And just to be super clear, it's something that gets overlooked a lot. These probes haven't quite left the solar system yet. They're in interstellar space because they're kind of beyond the effects of the sun and its magnetic field and its particles and all that. But they're still well within what most astronomers consider the confines of the solar system. They've got hundreds of years left to go before they're out beyond that. So they're out in interstellar space. They can detect things that that humans have never been able to detect before, find out what kind of sparse gases, what possible magnetic fields, what the conditions are like out beyond the sun's influence. But there's still so much left of the universe. It's kind of exciting to think.
Are there any plans in the works for more satellites like Voyage 1 and Voyage 2 moving forward?
Well, there's always plans, right? Astronomers are kind of an optimistic bunch. There's always somebody thinking about the next big idea. But I think right now that's all that we really have is just ideas. They're really focusing in right now on specific goals and targets. You mentioned Mars habitability. That's a real favorite. Maybe going back to the moon first, and even just getting people into space again. Just to remind everybody, we as a nation can't do that yet. Right now, the space shuttles have retired, and we're just kind of hitching rides on the Russian fleets right now. So, you know, there's so much that there is to cover for outer space that it's just tough to be able to pick a target.
We're talking to Bill Andrews and Anna Groves right now about the biggest science news of 2018. They're both editors at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What science stories stood out to you this year? What science news do you think flew under the radar? What questions do you have about some of these stories? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Right now, we continue our conversation about the year in science news with Bill Andrews and Anna Groves of Discover Magazine.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your number one science story of the year? What kind of science and technology news interests you the most? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Anna, let's move back to people and a big controversy in the realm of genetic engineering this year. Chinese scientist He Xinkui announced via YouTube that he had used CRISPR technology to make a set of twin girls who he referred to under the pseudonyms Lulu and Nana. Immune to HIV, researchers were swift with their condemnation. How come?
Well, this was a big surprise to the research community that Dr. He made this announcement. So his claim was that he had used CRISPR technologies to edit human embryos and implant them in a human, and those pregnancies had come to term and resulted in two twin baby girls. So a lot of these steps had never been done before. And even some of the researchers who have been working on human genome engineering and gene editing all seem to agree that this technology was not ready to be taken to clinical trials and used to make an actual pregnancy. So that was why so many were so shocked.
It sounds like Dr. He had a huge PR campaign, but then at the same time was very secretive about what he was doing. Is that was that one of the problems as to why so many scientists and so many people in the field had an issue with him?
Yeah, people couldn't believe that he had done this sort of secretly, and it more and more information has been coming out. Apparently his university that he at one point was employed at or was on leave from, those details aren't clear to me, but apparently the university didn't even know. There's some question about whether the parents of these babies were truly informed of what was happening with their embryo. And really, a lot of people argue for, as we're doing human gene editing research and anything moving forward should be made transparent. Pretty much the whole scientific community agrees that that is the only way to move forward. So the fact that Dr. He sort of kept this a surprise was really shocking and really upset a lot of people.
So it sounds like researchers in moving forward are going to have to set new guidelines as to the procedures and how these experimental projects move forward.
Right, right.
Bill, let's quickly chat about the intersection of space and politics. You know, usually we talk about funding for programs like NASA, but there was another big space policy story this year, the Space Force. Remind us what the Space Force was.
Yeah, it sounds so cool and dramatic, right? The Space Force.
Yes.
It's sort of what it sounds like. Donald Trump has proposed a sixth branch of the armed forces. You know, the Army, the Navy, blah, and now also the Space Force. And the reasoning sounds a little crazier than it might actually be. So there's some basis behind why they want to do this. And we are increasingly seeing operations take place in space beyond Earth's atmosphere, right? Not just satellite reconnaissance and surveillance, but even things like communication, only possible through space technology, navigation, better maps, all this kind of stuff. So maybe it makes sense to have a devoted branch of the military that monitors this, that takes place in it. And the more I've read into it, the more kind of also people are squeezing in the idea of space war fighting, which sounds amazing in a way. It's like, oh, great, the Star Wars. We're going to get the cockpits out in space and the guys
right.
with the space laser, pew, pew. But, I mean, that's not... That doesn't actually seem like it's going to happen. That's just, you know, maybe far off in the future. And this is to get it all in place at the ground floor, if it even happens. We'll have to see.
There's been some talk about Space Command as well. What is the difference between the two?
So it seems like Space Command is something that is possible for the Trump administration to create kind of on their own. And it would create Space Command as kind of a division within the existing infrastructures of the armed forces, kind of equivalent to, you know, there's somebody in charge of the North American sphere and the Middle Eastern sphere. That would be kind of another sphere, sort of like that. Whereas the Space Force itself, a whole new branch of the military, would require an act of Congress. It would require a lot more policy, a lot more rules, a lot more bureaucracy, you know, for better or worse, to figure out. So there's a better chance that Space Command takes place and becomes a thing. But, you know, it's hard to tell either direction. Maybe nothing is going to happen with this new Congress in place, or maybe everything is going to happen and we'll have a new Space Force by 2020, like our Commander-in-Chief wants.
Anna, we've had some cool news come out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison this year, though it might not sound super exciting, but it was about corn. Can you tell us about this corn discovery?
Well, first of all, I have to say it was very exciting to me, but I'm biased. I have a plant biology background. So this new discovery was corn that fixes nitrogen. So let me back up a little bit. So traditionally, we know that corn needs a lot of fertilizer, especially here in the Midwest. And one of the reasons why they need that is because they need nitrogen. And there's nitrogen in the air naturally, but it's not in a form that the corn can use. In some plants, like soybeans and actually all beans, the plants can get nitrogen not from the air but from bacteria that live in their roots that can take this nitrogen from the air and convert it to a different form, and then the plants can soak it up just like it's fertilizer. So for decades, I would say, scientists have been trying to figure out a way to get corn to do this, to partner with nitrogen-fixing bacteria so that they wouldn't need as much fertilizer. But the discovery this summer was that researchers found a corn growing in Oaxaca, Mexico, that was already doing this on its own. So this corn was totally crazy. It has these weird finger-like structures that are coming out of its stem. You have to look up pictures of this if you haven't seen it. They poke out of the middle of the stem. They're kind of like roots, but they don't connect to the ground at all. They're just hovering in the air, and they're covered with this goopy gel. And inside the gel, the plant is secreting a bunch of sugars that the bacteria are eating, and there's bacteria that are pulling nitrogen from the air, converting it to a form that the corn can use, and sort of feeding it to it like fertilizer.
Interesting. What does this mean then, or possibly mean, for agriculture in the future? I mean, obviously, is corn today, could it move on to something else tomorrow?
I don't know about something besides corn, but if we could get this trait from this Oaxacan corn into our Midwestern corn that we're growing, it would be huge. The scientists found that this Oaxacan corn was getting somewhere between 30 and 80% of its nitrogen from the bacteria in the gel instead of the soil. So think about if we could reduce our nitrogen fertilizer use here in the Midwest by 30 to 80%, even if it was less than that, that would still be huge in terms of energy use, because fertilizer creation is really energy intensive, and also in terms of pollution, because nitrogen fertilizers that we apply to farm fields is a big source of runoff and polluting our waterways.
Bill, paleontologists announced the discovery of a massive dinosaur this year. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's called, and I've been practicing this, Ledumahadi Mafubi, a name that translates to the giant thunderclap at dawn. It's a very evocative name. And they found it in South Africa. It is not quite the biggest dinosaur known, but it was the biggest of its time. And in fact, when it came about 200 million years ago is when it was roaming, it was the biggest animal ever at that point. It was the biggest animal ever on the face of the earth, as far as we know. And it's significant not just because, cool, you know, another dinosaur, it's neat. They've done nice drawings of it. It looks very friendly, very nice. But it's significant evolutionarily because it is part of the line of, it is called a sauropodomorph. But it's part of the line of sauropods. And if you think about your classic dinosaurs, you're with the long necks and the long tails, your brontosauruses, your apatosauruses, your diplodocuses, these are all sauropods, and they're very massive, they're very big, and they have these thick trunk-like legs, right? And so scientists had thought that you need those kinds of legs to be able to get that big and become a massive dinosaur. But this new one that they found, Ledumahadi, is a pretty giant dinosaur. It's about twice as big as an elephant. And it doesn't have legs like that. It has flexible legs that it could walk around on. So it showed scientists that some of what they thought was necessary to create a lot of the dinosaurs we know about is not actually the case. And anytime you have to re-examine your kind of preconceived notions about how things work, it's a good day in science.
With less than a couple minutes left, I wanted to quickly ask you both. I'll start with you, Bill. What will you be looking for in 2019?
Oh, there's a lot going on. In the solar system alone, we have probes at the sun. We have a probe at Jupiter that we're going to learn new things about. On New Year's Day itself, when everyone else is counting down, scientists are going to be counting down the flyby of a probe out a billion miles beyond Pluto, a little speck of rock they call Ultima Thule that we've never seen anything out there before. It's from this region of the solar system that we've never explored. Super exciting. And there's also a chance we might see our first up-close pictures of a black hole this year. So fingers crossed for a lot of good stuff in space science, at least.
Anna, with about 30 seconds left, what are some of the stories you'll be looking for in the new year?
I'm most excited to find out what the new developments are going to be on this human gene editing issue and where some of the researchers that are doing more responsible work and trying to be ethical about their decisions, I'm excited to find out where that's going to take us next.
Bill, Anna, thank you so much for spending time with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bill Andrews is a senior associate editor, and Anna Groves is an assistant editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. They join us today to talk about some of the biggest science news in 2018.
Still time for you to share your favorite science story of the year. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas at WPR.org. On this day in 1969, music history was made.
James Brown and his band recorded the song Funky Drummer. The beat by the late legendary Clyde Stubblefield went on to become one of the most heavily sampled tracks in history.
Here's a super cut of some songs that used the beat, thanks to our own Carl Christensen.
Boogie, jive, and rap is life where I'm from. Where I'm from, a mod play with Izzy where I'm from. Where I'm from, it be like run your coat black. Jupiter keeps a fat beat.
Yeah, yeah. Freedom. Let you down. Freedom.
Clyde Stubblefield lived for years here in Wisconsin and had a long connection with us here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
So we mark this every year now as Funky Drummer Day here on Central Time.
I want